Pandemic brooding, brown tech in new clothing. Parts of this essay have already been published as Pandemic Brooding, Can the Permaculture Movement Survive the First Severe Test of the Energy Descent Future? In this longer essay, I'm exploring the responses to the pandemic in light of my future scenarios work. The welcome signs of spring are all around me at Meliodora and Spring Creek, after a wet and gloomy winter. With very little passive solar gain, we burnt more wood, and with barely enough photovoltaic power to pump water and power a few other essential functions, we relied on backup from the Victorian grid, still dominated by coal, despite the impressive rollout of wind farms around our region. It was damp enough to remind us of the old days before the acceleration of climate change, which has given us more winter sun but less groundwater recharge or fungal decomposition to moderate the fuel loads during the ensuing fire season. Every day in the office, we could watch a huge family of chuffs working the veggie gardens for worms to offset the cold seeping through their bedraggled plumage. Despite the protestations of the chuffs and many human folk, it wasn't a cold winter. Grass kept growing slowly where the hordes of kangaroos that have invaded the town haven't eaten it to the ground. Frost damage on tender subtropicals was minimal, and the Bureau of Meteorology data confirmed my sense that this was one of the mildest winters on record right across the continent. In this case, at least, my observations were backed up by what these days is called the science. So, with the relief of a wet winter to moderate the coming fire season, why should I feel so much trepidation about the near future? Spring was a time of death and rebirth in our Celtic tradition, long before Easter marked the death and rebirth of Christ. The threat of famines was always greatest in spring, as flowers nourished the soul, but not necessarily the gut. But in this case, as with many people, it's the pandemic that has been getting me down, even though my personal circumstances are about as good as it gets. While the pandemic itself is an interesting and, of course, tragic phenomenon for many, it's hardly more so than the myriad of other expressions of how humanity is hitting the limits to growth right on schedule, as suggested 50 years ago. But the collective response of humanity to the novel coronavirus is, in my view, the really interesting and maybe also tragic phenomenon. My earlier writings on the subject showed a restrained excitement for the potential of the pandemic to stimulate a massive increase in people interested in home food growing and all the other enlightened self-interest activities embodied in the household and community non-monetary economies celebrated in my retro suburbia vision and work. Our teams at Holmgren Design, Meliodora Publishing and Permaculture Principles poured a huge effort into supporting that rapidly expanding interest and were rewarded enough that we didn't need to put our hand out for the government's largesse. Our colleagues at Milkwood Permaculture had a challenge meeting the demand for their online permaculture living course. In The Class Divide in the Time of Pandemic, I was more polemic about the opportunities as well as the necessity to build a new economy in the shadow of the old system. I mentioned how the old system would be plagued by increasing dysfunction and arbitrary power by governments, reflecting the structural characteristics of the brown tech energy descent scenario I outlined in future scenarios. Earlier this year, in The Problem is the Solution, but the solutions can turn back into the same old problems, I explored the ways a dark inverse of this permaculture aphorism keeps humanity heading towards greater dysfunction, a theme in my thinking since at least the mid-1990s. As the pandemic rolled over into its second year, I became concerned that the psychosocial fallout of the pandemic, and especially the pandemic response at the global and local levels, could represent an existential threat to permaculture and kindred movements. At one level, this threat is the same as that to families, workplaces, networks, and organisations more generally, where a sense of urgency to implement the official response, especially lockdowns and mass vaccination, is producing a huge gulf between an ever more certain majority and a smaller minority questioning and challenging that official response. My aim in this essay is to focus on how critically important it is to use all our physical, emotional, and intellectual resources towards maintaining connections across what could be a widening gulf of frustration and distrust within our movement, reflecting society at large. I want to explore how permaculture ethics and design principles can help us empathetically bridge that gulf without necessarily needing to censor our truth or simply avoid the issue. While the pandemic and the responses to it will pass in time, I believe the future will be characterized by similar issues that test our ability to tolerate uncertainty and diversity, and thus to exercise solidarity within kin, collegiate, and network communities of practice. Before diving into how ethical and ecological wisdom might help us navigate these immediate concerns, I think it's important that I zoom out to clarify how the big picture energy descent future scenarios framework can provide some perspective and diffuse some of the source of emotional heat of polarization around current events. The positive, grounded thinking that characterizes permaculture has always been informed by a dark view of the state of the world and long-term emerging threats. It originated in a hotbed of pioneering environmental activism in Tasmania, at a time when the Limits to Growth report, published by the Club of Rome, was big news, at least in the circles that Mollison and I moved in. In crafting the permaculture design course, Mollison used to spend a day on what he called evidence for the necessity of permaculture. In Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, I nailed my colours to the mast in clarifying that permaculture was a design response to energy descent as the most likely future that humanity will face once stocks of fossil fuels are depleted and their combustion tips us into the Pyrocene. In 2006, Richard Heinberg and I joined forces to show how permaculture was an existing, designed, bottom-up and creative response to the twin threats of peak oil and climate change. In 2008, with the help of Adam Grubb, founder of Energy Bulletin, now resilience.org, I published Future Scenarios as an online, open access exploration of four near future scenarios: Brown Tech, Green Tech, Earth Steward, and Lifeboat. All driven by the variable rate of oil and resource depletion on the one hand, and the rate of onset of serious climate change on the other. This work led to some recognition in the academic field of future studies, but my main aim was to help Permies focused on grounded strategies with some over-the-horizon thinking about the world we might be designing for. In 2011, I teamed up with Nicole Foss to explore and explain how the faster-moving human construct of finance and economics might give near-term expression to the slower but more fundamental variables of resource depletion and climate change. Most significantly, in 2013, in an essay, Crash on Demand, Welcome to the Brown Tech Future, I called which of my four scenarios I thought was already emergent only 6 years after I first conceived them. While picking winners is not the point of scenario planning, I thought the signs were clear enough to do so. Crash on Demand was controversial in the then limited energy descent, degrowth, collapse networks. For my musings on how burnt out climate activists might find some shred of agency by moving to permaculture activism, I hypothesised that if some minority of the global middle class adopted a radical mix of permaculture productivity and voluntary frugality, the reduction in consumption might be enough to collapse the teetering global financial system and thus stall the material economy before uncontrolled tipping points cooked our world with 3, 4 or more degrees of heating. The adverse effects on people of a global depression would be terrible, but it might give us the time and the shock to reset our expectations for a sufficiency economy. It's the lot of futurists to be wrong, at least in our more detailed portraits of the future. But it is only by painting a picture that potential concrete outcomes of powerful but abstract systemic forces and factors can be illustrated and more easily understood. In using concrete examples to illustrate the systemic change, I got some of these details wrong. As oil prices came down and supply shortages didn't eventuate, at least for the global middle class, the interest in peak oil collapsed due to the extraordinary growth in shale oil and gas production, mostly in the USA. Reading reports by independent petroleum experts calculating that shale needed over $80 a barrel to be economically viable. Back then I reasoned that this price would be high enough to crush at least the discretionary economy in long affluent countries and have severe impacts in poor countries. However, a combination of interest-free money from the quantitative easing response to the GFC, dismantled environmental regulations, and investors deluded by bubble economics led to Saudi America being able to keep the punters driving and, most importantly, continue to flex its muscles in efforts at regime change and proxy wars. Combined with the grinding down of consumption by stagnating wages and insecure work, the more obvious expected effects of the peak in conventional oil production were masked by the shale boom. It is a great irony that I had too much faith in the rationality of markets to not invest where there was little prospect of getting their money back. I think the pandemic ensures the world is unlikely to produce more liquid fuel than the 2018 peak of total petroleum and other liquids. Whether this is primarily an accidental or planned outcome of the response to the pandemic belated climate policies and divestment, or simply depletion finally overtaking the now fading Herculean efforts to bring forward new production, can be debated by future historians. The pandemic may also mark other related peaks, that of global industrial production, food production, human population, and greenhouse gas emissions. That would align very closely with the 1972 Limits to Growth default run of the World 3 computer model. I've always been skeptical that the population would ever reach 10 billion before declining due to natural demographic transition. The main factors behind this belief were declining net energy and, more recently, climate change, as reflected in future scenarios, while always acknowledging the compounding factors of ecological degradation, species diversity loss, geopolitical, financial, and microbiological instability, to mention a few. Maybe the pandemic and the resulting knock-on effects will be the recognised mechanism for a 2030 peak in global population at less than 9 billion, with the decline post-peak primarily attributed to climate chaos. I think it's also possible that historians will point to data on excess deaths associated with the pandemic and its consequences as causing peak humanity at 8 billion in 2021. I also need to acknowledge being wrong about another expectation that emerged from my future scenarios work and informed Retrosuburbia. I fully expected the property bubble in Australia and many other affluent countries would likely pop at the next stress point following the fake wealth creation during and since the GFC. I had already concluded that financial contagion would mask oil depletion as a driver for economic depression and consequent longer-term energy descent. Late in 2019, I noticed various sources suggesting growing instabilities in the bond markets that I barely understand, that were reaching a critical point. The global spread of the virus led to an explosion of money printing, dwarfing that in response to the GFC. And it worked, at least so far, in boosting the stock and housing markets into a new frenzy of disaster capitalism. The scale of fake wealth creation via bonds, debts, and derivatives is almost impossible to comprehend. Life in a pandemic certainly has many of the characteristics of the second Great Depression of my Aussie Street story. But of course, creative writing and storytelling are not subject to such critical review as serious futures work. My futures work is still little understood, or even read in permaculture circles, where most people are understandably focused on making good stuff happen. However, I think it is important that I review my brown tech scenario. This was explored in workshops around Australia as well as overseas from 2006 to 2013, before I became fully focused on Retrosuburbia as the most important positive response that I could help stimulate in response to the brown tech world. Brown tech is driven by a slow decline in oil and rapid onset of serious climate change. Many people imagine the brown tech scenario is characterized by climate change denial at the top, making things worse. The bit about top-down responses making things worse was true, but not the climate denial. Late, but strong emergency level response to climate change in a context of crisis would be a more accurate portrait of the scenario. The slowly declining conventional oil, after a peak in about 2008, and other key resources still provide enough energy to run globally connected, technologically complex, urban-centred societies. However, the rapid decline in net energy available after that needed to maintain and expand the energy industries causes constriction in consumption and other stresses that have many of the characteristics of recession and depression, even if the signals that mainstream economists follow remain largely buoyant. At the same time, rapidly accelerating climate change beyond the worst mainstream projections of 2007 generates more intense and frequent extreme weather events, droughts, wildfires, and other natural disasters, impacting global food supply and triggering mass migrations. These two primary drivers interact and amplify associated geopolitical, financial, and psychosocial stresses that have been challenging the Pax Americana, the peace held by the American Empire, at least in the affluent parts of the world, since the end of the Second World War. At the global scale, ecological energetics theory suggests that declining net energy to support humanity should lead to a contraction in the number of hierarchical levels of power, just as a massive increase in net energy has supported the development of international governance structures in the aftermath of World War II, especially the UN and its subsidiaries. Declining net energy suggests prior levels of organisational power, most notably the nation state, are likely to become more powerful, at least relative to the barely emergent global institutions. Further background is important in understanding the signs and signals that contributed to crafting the Brown Tech scenario. Following the collapse of the Soviet Union at the beginning of the 1990s, the World Bank, IMF, WTO, International Bank of Settlements, and other instruments of Pax Americana became fully hegemonic. The neoliberal ideology of the 80s and 90s, initiated by what I always called the Thatcherite-Reaganite revolution, celebrated and fed off the hubris of this victory. The internet, and other expressions of rapidly accelerating globalization. However, since the turn of the millennium, crises reveal the neoliberal ideological commitment to laissez-faire market forces led by corporations was skin deep. Over the last 20 years, governments have been moving towards a command economy in response to financial, geopolitical, and climatic crises, where strong stimuli, carrots and sticks, are used to force business and people to act in ways driven by the emergency level policies, similar to what occurs in wartime mobilization. With a decline in public sector capacity, governments rely on corporations to do most of the heavy lifting, but increasingly at the behest of government rather than shareholders. Higher oil prices in the early 2000s, in response to accelerating depletion of cheaper conventional oil reserves, gave rise to resource nationalism. This was most notable in Russia and Venezuela, where strong nationalist governments pushed back against the global system that previously gave resources to whoever had the most US dollars. I saw these events, along with the revolt in the 1999 of third world countries against the proposed WTO trade rules as possibly signalling the peak and decline of globalisation. I had been watching for signs of peaking globalisation as an indirect indicator of declining net energy, at least declining net energy per capita. Tragically, net energy studies remain unfunded, confused, and hotly debated, even in the energy sector. The idea that they could act as forward indicators of geopolitical and governance regimes is still at the fringes of academic discourse. This energetic and ecological worldview is the same thinking that led to permaculture. And while I understand it is out of sync with almost all human-centered views of the world, it continues to help me work from the big picture patterns to relevant details of creative responses. While information technology and the rise of China as the factory of the world appeared to suggest endless accelerating globalization, since 2000, the subtle signs of declining net energy and consequently relocalization of power structures have been increasing. For Permies and kindred folk, relocalization is about community-level empowerment. But in crafting my future scenarios, the degree of relocalization reflects net energy availability and ecosystem service functionality rather than conscious political choices. In all energy descent scenarios, the barely emergent global governance structures contract or fail, while national, city and hinterland, locality and household come collective levels of power grow to varying degrees to fill the power vacuum created by failing higher levels of governance. Consequently, the rise of command economies led by strong central governments, such as in China, but with more trade wars, proxy wars, and megaphone diplomacy, can be considered a form of relocalization from global governance. In my workshops, I quite enjoyed watching reactions to this reframing of the relocalization concept. 9/11 triggered regime change wars across the world to try to maintain and reinforce Pax Americana. Like efforts to sustain overextended empires throughout history, this bloody strategy and its fig leaf explanation, the War on Terror, only accelerated resource depletion and climate change and led to the death and displacement of millions and impoverishment of masses of middle-class citizens in the USA and other long affluent countries. The rise of the surveillance state has been a critically important part of the shift to command economies. The War on Terror was the justification for funding a massive expansion of government bureaucracy and powers, such as Homeland Security in the US, novel forms of detention, such as Guantanamo Bay, and global punishment beatings to intimidate, for example, Julian Assange. Much of the infrastructure and data for the surveillance state has piggybacked on the business model of the tech giants, harvesting big data about everyone and everything. The global middle class and now the working poor have given away data by unwittingly funding free services they could not do without. At least in these early stages of the command economy, the population has been managed with carrots rather than sticks. The financialization of the economy gave those in the middle class the continuing sense of affluence through housing, stock market, and other bubble economies. The obscene wealth accumulation and corruption at the top, disquiet and dread about the future in the middle class, and anger of the working poor have driven new political agendas, movements and governments, ranging from populist, nationalist policies on the political right to bold Keynesian proposals on the left, such as the various Green New Deals, to direct this wealth to the greater good. What most of the participants in these debates fail to understand is that money is not real wealth, and that the growth of money / debt, not backed by resources, since the 1970s, can only succeed in sucking real wealth from Mother Earth and human creativity for so long. I must admit, I thought the GFC would be the end of this madness with a greater Great Depression. Since then, the money fabrication has accelerated, but most of that wealth creation has ended up in the pockets of a few corporations, hedge funds, and their super-rich shareholders. In trying to understand the accumulation of obscene wealth at the top, an idea by Eric Lindberg struck me as very plausible, reshaping my own understanding. The super-rich are so few in number that there is a limit to how many Rolls-Royces they can drive or how much caviar and champagne they can consume. Leaving aside some novel forms of high-energy consumption like the space tourism race, most of the virtual wealth of the super-rich is parked in forms that don't directly lead to demand for more resources and energy. On the other hand, any scheme to redistribute this wealth, whether to publicly mandated infrastructure or given to the citizens of already affluent countries, or even those in poor countries, would immediately stimulate demand for material and energy resources from Mother Nature. Apart from furthering environmental degradation and climate chaos, this would trigger multiple limits to resource supply, causing runaway prices and accelerating regime change to maintain supply, while sucking resources out of every other sector of the economy. For example, the International Energy Agency has recently forecast that to achieve global climate targets, the world annual mining of lithium needs to increase 42-fold by 2040. This is just one of the essential elements needed for the renewable energy transition. By parking the wealth with the rich, the collapse of the completely fake global financial system is being held at bay, for the time being at least. How this explanation could reframe attitudes and actions to personal and collective level could be the subject of a whole essay, but I haven't got around to following that path beyond seeding the explanation here and there. This is just some of the brown tech context in which governments find themselves forced to take control and use crises to leverage change in social democratic societies, where it is otherwise almost impossible to do so. Command economies in societies such as China increasingly become the model for how to deal with threats, both external and internal, at the same time that our propaganda focuses on demonizing those societies. This combination of strong central government rallying the public around national goals and using the power of corporations to achieve critical ends has a name. It was Mussolini's definition of fascism, although today the word is more of a term of abuse. I think it is technically correct to describe China as a fascist state, but to do so today just adds to the anti-China hysteria. Whatever the new temporary global or regional hegemonic power in charge, The command economic system is inherently unsustainable over longer-term energy descent, although it could last for several decades before it fails completely. In my future scenarios model, the more benign green tech scenario would naturally segue to Earth Steward in response to ongoing energy descent, perhaps after decades of stability, as told in my story, History from the Future, set in Jarrah Country here in central Victoria and told from the perspective of 2086. Unfortunately, brown tech is more likely to lead to armouring of urban systems against accelerating climate and other crises, but will eventually break down to the lifeboat scenario at some point in this century. Leaving aside these longer-term possibilities, we urgently need to understand and work out how to navigate the brown tech scenario which is hardening around us. Especially significant for permaculture and other fringe groups and networks is the brown tech characteristic of a systemic tension between centralised armouring and peripheral abandonment. Governments are likely to withdraw services from rural hinterlands but invest to protect those in cities, especially capital cities. The city-country divide grows despite some temporary reversals due to the dynamics of communication infrastructure and autonomous power rollout. In the green tech scenario, these and other aspects of the renewable energy transition distribute more economic power to hinterlands. But in the brown tech world, a late response to the climate crisis is likely to see the renewable energy rollout controlled by corporations rather than community co-ops like our local Hepburn Wind. While jobs for sparkies and other trades servicing the renewable rollout, combined with more mining of needed materials and minerals, might keep parts of rural Australia booming, the net yields from all this activity are still likely to be focused on armouring urban centres and centralised supply logistics. In Future Scenarios workshops, I illustrated this tension between town and country with the example of bushfire leading to closure of the single line Earth Return power lines that the Black Saturday Royal Commission said should be placed underground. I suggested governments might offer cents on the dollar for remote and hard to defend rural properties to encourage people to relocate to defendable towns and cities. So far, the response in the real world has mostly been a continuation of muddling through with a mix of market and tech solutions, such as autonomous rural power, and bigger government budgets for command and control, firefighting and evacuations. In these workshops, I also suggested the armouring of the centre and abandonment of the periphery is also likely to apply in ways other than geographic. As stresses and strains on social welfare, health, and other services increase, the government is likely to force people to accept undesirable positions within the economy to ensure the increasingly expensive armoury of complex technology-heavy systems, which would ensure a critical mass of consumers and skilled workers on tap to maintain viability. For example, to justify some expensive piece of medical equipment, hospitals need more patients, but the health system is already struggling with too many needy consumers. The alternative will be to become more self and collectively reliant without access to centralised services. My other example is close to the heart and gut of most permies. As climate, energy, and geopolitical stresses increasingly threaten the centralized food system, corporations know they need to move towards monopoly power within markets and squash fringe competition from farmers' markets, community-supported agriculture, and community and home gardens. However, funding from different levels of government is used to encourage community gardens and new niche farming enterprises, for example. Policies of one department or level of government will be contradicting those of others, creating a systemic schizophrenia. For the ordinary citizen, these tensions between encouraging centralized consumption and work while simultaneously encouraging peripheral self-reliance will be experienced as a choice between security and comfort at a cost to autonomy versus the ideal of autonomy and freedom, but with great uncertainty and risk of failure, sanction, or even outlaw status. In Aussie Street, I painted the picture suggesting that access to guaranteed and rationed food at Moles and Bullies would be dependent on having an Australia ID card. In History from the Future, I added a political tension as a strong centralising Labor government in Canberra and a somewhat libertarian Liberal government in Melbourne pulled in different directions.